Welcome to the Chris Business Hour. From the Bear Cave, I'm Barry Slater, and today we will focus on the top stories from around the world, the nation, and the state. Starting off with this week's Hartford Business Journal, our first article is written by Hannah Snyder Gambini. It's titled, "With $2 million Brownfields Grant and New Ownership, Former Stanadyne Campus in Windsor Locks Looks for New Life." The town of Windsor has been awarded more than $2 million for environmental and remediation work at former industrial sites that will become a new riverfront business park, town officials said. A $2 million Brownfields grant was awarded June 14th by the State Department of Economic and Community Development for remediation work at the former Stanadyne plant at 90-92 Deerfield Road. Another $200,000 was awarded to conduct an environmental assessment study of a neighboring property, which will collectively become part of a new Connecticut River Business Park. Ohio-based IRG Industrial Realty Group, LLC, bought the fully vacant property in late 2023 for $250,000. It covers 52 acres and contains three empty buildings. The campus now has 740,000 square feet of flex space that will soon be leased to multiple tenants. Buildings range from 500,000 square feet down to 90,000 square feet, and the spaces are flexible in their use, said Windsor Economic Development Director Patrick McMahon, who said IRG has made significant upgrades to all three buildings in order to try to bring in new businesses to Windsor. Ideal uses include manufacturing, distribution, assembly, storage, office, or laboratory. Commercial real estate firm JLL is the leasing broker. One building is available now for lease, and more space will come online when the site work is completed, McMahon said. The remediation work will follow IRG's previous work on the campus, including exterior cleanup and security improvements, along with interior work, which will include wall demolition and new lighting and painting. IRG bought the property in a bankruptcy sale and plans to invest at least $5 million into building improvements and upgrades, said IRG Senior Vice President Peter Goffstein. Windsor was among several municipalities to receive a remediation grant, which, according to the DECD, will enable the adaptive reuse of the property to a business park that will provide new manufacturing, research and development, warehousing, distribution, and offices to meet local market demand. IRG has also purchased properties in Torrington, New Britain, Meriden, and East Hartford, including the former Pratt & Whitney aircraft manufacturing facility in Southington. Stanadyne is a gas and diesel fuel injection systems manufacturer that was founded in 1876 as Hartford Machine Screw Company and renamed Standard Screw Company in 1900. In 2009, Stanadyne announced plans to close its Deerfield Road manufacturing plant and relocate 250 employees to North Carolina. Next up from the Hartford Business Journal, an article written by Andrew Larson titled, "Bridge Family Center to Open a New Parenting Center in Cromwell and Move Counseling Center from Avon to Farmington." The Bridge Family Center plans to open a new parenting center in Cromwell and relocate an existing counseling center in Avon to a larger space in Farmington. The West Hartford-based nonprofit provides services for children and families in Greater Hartford, including a safe haven for children and families in crisis, as well as intervention and prevention programs. The Bridge plans to acquire a commercial building at 600 Corporate Row in Cromwell, where it will open a new parenting center. The 6,100-square-foot building previously housed Tri-Lacan Development Corporation. The new parenting center, expected to open in the fall, will operate in tandem with the Bridges Mosaic Parenting Center at 664 Farmington Avenue in Hartford. The parenting centers handle referrals from the Department of Children and Families. They provide training aimed at helping parents regain custody of their children. The Bridge plans to hire 10 to 12 new employees for the new parenting center, which is expected to receive about 4,000 visits annually. Also, the Bridge has reached an agreement to lease 2,530 square feet in an office building at 2 Bridgewater Road in Farmington for outpatient counseling services. The organization plans to move its Bridge West Counseling Center at 45 West Main Street in Avon to the new location by August 1st, said Margaret Hahn, the organization's executive director. The new Farmington location is more modern and has about 500 square feet of additional space. We were there in Avon for quite a few years, and it served its purpose very well. But now we're looking to make a change, Hahn said, adding it's a little bit brighter, a little bit more cheery, and a little higher visibility. She said the organization received a grant from the Martin Foundation to assist with the relocation. The Bridge's main office is at 1022 Farmington Avenue in West Hartford. Its other two counseling centers in Vernon and West Hartford will remain open in addition to its Family Resource Center at Charter Oak Academy. The Bridge's 990 filing for the 2022 tax year lists total revenue of $8.7 million and total expenses of $8.2 million. Next, an article written by Greg Bordenaro titled CBS Health Foundation Grants 15 Connecticut Nonprofits $750,000. The charitable arm of CBS Health, parent company of Hartford Health Insurance, Aetna, announced it has provided $750,000 in grants to 15 nonprofits in Connecticut. The funding came from the CBS Health Foundation's Hometown Fund, which supports nonprofits located where the company has major headquarters operations. In Connecticut, nonprofits located within a 20-mile radius of the city of Hartford were eligible to apply for funding, which can be used for general operating support. 15 Connecticut nonprofits were awarded $50,000 each this year, according to the foundation. They included the Compass Youth Collaborative in Hartford, the Hartford Gay and Lesbian Health Collective in Hartford, the Mercy Housing and Shelter Corporation, Health Equity Solutions, YMCA Hartford Region, the Center for Latino Progress, Dignity Grows, and Urban League of Greater Hartford. All of those are located in Hartford. We are confident that our 2024 grantees will continue transforming lives in Connecticut, as well as playing a vital role in enhancing the well-being and health of our community, said Cheryl Burke, Senior Vice President of Corporate Social Responsibility and Chief Sustainability Officer. Next, from the Hartford Business Journal, an article written by Hannah Snyder Gambini titled, New Owners Convert Historic Cheshire Home into a Collaborative Co-working Space. A historic building in the heart of Cheshire, purchased in 2021, is now open as a collaborative workspace for artistic and professional business people. Jennifer Tansley of Southington in early May opened Muse Co-working Collective at 275 Maple Avenue in Cheshire. She and Scott Tansley of Moxie Properties, LLC, bought the 3,000-square-foot building in 2021 for $370,000 and have since invested close to $150,000 in renovations and design. The team included architect David Arai of Hartford-based Meyer Design Group. The property has a long history, first as a residential home, then offices. At one time, it was a dorm for Cheshire Academy, and most recently had two apartments and an office in the back, Tansley said. She is now taking bookings for the spaces, ranging from daily or weekly reservations. The building has collaborative spaces and no private offices, but small conference and meeting rooms are available to book for a few hours or a day, she said. Tansley had been working as a wedding planner for the past 10 years and said the idea for the collaborative space sprung from working in that sector. She said many professionals in the wedding industry, like photographers or planners, don't have offices and are looking for collaborative spaces and places to meet clients. Tansley's initial inspiration was to open to professionals related to wedding planning, but she's been getting inquiries from financial advisors, insurance agents, and others in the professional services realm who are looking for spots to meet clients. The 1860 Victorian home is different from most co-working spaces, Tansley said, and she decorated it in a way to make it a home away from home. I like the comforts of home without the distraction, she said, adding, I wanted it to be reflective of my style and not a corporate space. Next, an article written by Greg Bordenaro titled, High Vacancy Downtown Stamford Office Building Sells for $7 Million. The prominent developer eyes a luxury hotel conversion. A downtown Stamford office building with a high vacancy rate was recently purchased by a high-profile local development firm that plans to convert the property into a luxury hotel, according to its website. The 101,143-square-foot office building at 300 Main Street sold for a second time in 5 years in May for $7 million, land records show. The buyer was Stamford-based F.D. Rich Company, a major urban developer that has built a number of multifamily projects in its home city and elsewhere. According to its website, F.D. Rich said it recently acquired the commercial property with an attached 147-space garage for a planned adaptive reuse project that will be a combination of historic preservation, including of the exterior and grand double-height bank lobby, and a full interior conversion of office spaces into 149 luxury hotel rooms. The future hotel will highlight the historic features of this property while providing the most in-demand hotel amenities, including a proposed rooftop pool, the development firm said on its website, adding it anticipates the project will be completed in the summer of 2027. F.D. Rich did not return a call from Hartford Business Journal seeking comment. The 8-story building was being marketed for sale by commercial real estate services firm Avison Young as a potential office-to-residential conversion, according to marketing materials, which indicated only 18% of the office space is leased. The seller was Stamford-based real estate investment firm 20 Lake Holdings, which originally bought the property in 2019 for about $8.3 million, property records show. F.D. Rich has been active in recent years, selling off some key assets and proposing a large-scale 198-unit, 13-story apartment development in Stamford on Broad Street. In 2021 and 2022, the company sold for $175 million three multifamily properties, Summer House Stamford in Stamford and Harborside Sono and Sono Pearl, both in Norwalk, containing a combined 422 units. Well, you're listening to the Chris Business Hour. I'll be back with more after this break.
For the past 130 years, Oak Hill has served thousands of people in Connecticut. We offer a variety of programs such as Oak Hill School. Oak Hill School is a private, state-approved special education program for students ages 3 to 22. With classrooms across Connecticut, Oak Hill School provides an individualized, community-based program focused on building confidence and promoting independence. Oak Hill School, empowering people with disabilities. To find out more, visit oakhillct.org.
Welcome back to the Chris Business Hour. Back to this week's Hartford Business Journal, we have an article written by Keith Fanoff titled, Connecticut Diesel Tax to Jump 3 cents After a Year-Long Freeze. Connecticut's trucking industry will face a small tax hike next month when the state tax on diesel fuel rises slightly more than 3 cents per gallon. Truckers dodged a much larger increase over the past year when legislators and Governor Ned Lamont froze the tax, blocking a projected hike of nearly 12 cents per gallon. Still, the latest increase, coupled with a new highway mileage tax that began last year and a 9-cent diesel hike in 2022, has truckers and others calling for reforms. Thankfully, it's only going up a little bit, said Department of Revenue Services Commissioner Mark Boughton, who recently notified the legislature the per-gallon tax on diesel fuel would climb 3.2 cents on July 1st from 49.2 cents to 52.4. That's a 6.5% increase. Boughton noted the diesel tax has been adjusted annually each summer since 2007 based on statutory formula that relies heavily on wholesale diesel prices from the prior 12 months. The formula has generated several tax cuts over the last 17 years, he added. But the president of the Motor Transport Association of Connecticut, John Blair, said the new tax hike is the latest in a series of financial burdens recently placed on his group, which represents more than 500 trucking and trucking-related businesses. Though the diesel rate was frozen last July, it had risen 9 cents per gallon in July of 2022. Truckers also were frustrated in January of 2023 when the state launched a new highway mileage tax on many large commercial trucks, excluding those transporting dairy products. The diesel tax and highway mileage fee each represent a relatively modest share of the state budget's special transportation fund, which covers operating costs for the Department of Transportation and motor vehicles, as well as debt payments on bonding for highway, bridge, and rail projects. Final totals for the current fiscal year, which closes June 30th, weren't available this week, but Boughton said the diesel tax collected about $133.5 million in 2022-23, when the rate also was 49.2 cents per gallon. Those collections represented 7% of total STF expenditures in 2022-23 and about 6% in the current year. The highway mileage tax, which ranges from 2.5 cents per mile to 17.5 cents, depending on a truck's weight, will collect $60 million this fiscal year, according to Governor Ned Lamont's budget office. It represents less than 3% of the STF. Further complicating matters, the Transportation Fund has generated huge surpluses in recent years. The fund finished with a $157 million or 9% surplus 2 years ago, according to reports from the Comptroller's office. That's despite a gasoline tax holiday that put hundreds of millions of dollars back in motorists' pockets. Last fiscal year saw a $284 million surplus equal to 15.5% of the transportation fund. And the administrative projects the fund will close this fiscal year on June 30th up $283 million or 13%. Our next article from the Hartford Business Journal is written by Andrew Larson. It's titled, Another Eversource Subsidiary Takes Credit Hit from Ratings Agency. Eversource Energy took another hit from a major credit rating agency on Tuesday as Moody's Ratings downgraded its subsidiary, Connecticut Light and Power, to a negative outlook. Moody's said it made the decision to lower CL&P's rating from stable to negative, citing a challenging Connecticut regulatory environment. Although CL&P's cash flow will improve from the recovery of certain costs associated with authorized rate adjustment mechanisms, the long-term sustainability of this improvement will largely depend on the supportiveness of future regulatory decisions, said Jeff Casella, Vice President and Senior Credit Officer at Moody's. While CL&P has historically had a relatively stable financial profile, Moody said the company's financial performance began deteriorating in 2023. An upgrade is unlikely in the near term, the agency said, but CL&P's outlook could be changed to stable if the credit supportiveness of the Connecticut regulatory environment improves with future regulatory decisions that improve the timeliness of the recovery of costs and investments, including deferred storm costs, while providing sufficient allowed returns. The report does not mention the parent company's divestiture from offshore wind as relating to this credit action. CL&P is the largest operating subsidiary of Eversource, with about 1.28 million customers. In January, Moody's downgraded Eversource's outlook to negative, but kept CL&P's outlook as stable. In late May, Moody's Ratings downgraded Eversource subsidiary Aquarian Water Company's credit rating, citing a weakening financial profile. Eversource said the lower ratings are due to unpredictable and volatile regulatory policies and will result in higher costs for electricity, water, and gas. Next, from the Hartford Business Journal, an article written by Andrew Larson titled, Pullman & Cowley Moves It Into Upgraded Office in Springfield, Mass. Law firm Pullman & Cowley, or Comley, headquartered in Bridgeport, has moved its office in Springfield, Mass. Into a downtown office building. On June 11th, Pullman & Cowley had a ribbon cutting and reception to celebrate the opening of its new office on the ninth floor of Tower Square at 1500 Main Street. The office includes new video conferencing capabilities that connect with conference rooms in other Pullman & Cowley offices. Pullman & Cowley opened its original Springfield office, the firm's first in Massachusetts, in 2019. Lee Hoffman, chair of the firm, said the purpose of the move is to update the facilities to bring them in line with what our clients expect from a 21st century law office. Also, he said, the firm wanted to renew our commitment to being present in downtown Springfield. The firm is interviewing attorneys as it looks to expand its Springfield office. We intentionally took on space that had room to grow for that purpose, Hoffman said. Pullman & Cowley has several well-known local attorneys located in the Springfield office, including business, real estate, and litigation attorney James Martin, who is recognized as a leading automotive franchise attorney throughout New England. Also, Laura Bellotti Cardillo, vice chair of the firm's property tax and valuation practice, has helped grow the firm's Springfield office. Other Pullman attorneys working in Massachusetts include Megan Carinante, Joshua Hawks Lads, Brian Kirsch, Frederick Klein, and Tabitha Ayer. Next up, an article written by Skylar Fraser titled, Current Reporters Ratify Their First Union Contract. Reporters from the country's oldest continuously published newspaper have ratified their first union contract, the Hartford Current Guild announced. The Hartford Courant Guild, which was formed by newsroom reporters in February of 2019, and seven other Tribune publications owned by hedge fund Alden Global Capital, have ratified a new five-year contract that includes a 3% raise this month and another 3% raise next year. The contract also includes protections for existing 401k matches and job security initiatives, according to information from the Guild. In addition to the guaranteed raises and retirement fund protections, the new contract includes just cause provisions to prevent arbitrary discipline and termination, a grievance and arbitration process involving a third party for disputes, social media, and credit line rights. While negotiations for a union contract began in 2019, the Guild said cuts to the newsroom ramped up after the Hartford Courant and other publications were sold to Alden in 2021. In addition to the Hartford Courant, the Orlando Sentinel, Tidewater, and the Allentine Morning Call in Pennsylvania, the Chicago Tribune, Design and Production Studios, and Tribune Content Agency are covered by the contract, which saw 94% of union member support. When we created the Hartford Courant Guild over 5 years ago, it was in part to help ensure that the oldest continuously published newspaper in the United States continues to function, said Hartford Courant reporter Christopher Keating, co-chair of the Guild. This contract took 5 long years to complete and was accomplished only through the diligent work of our bargaining leaders, particularly former Courant reporter Daniela Altamari and sports reporter Lori Riley. They deserve credit for the gains that we made. The joint bargaining committee for the contract included 62 News Guild members. The Hartford Courant Guild represents 21 newsroom employees. Our first union contract at the Hartford Courant is historic, said Lori Riley, the unit co-chair, adding, "It's a testament to our determination and grit to foster a workplace that values transparency, fairness, and the pursuit of truth above all else." And rounding out the first half of this week's show from the Hartford Business Journal, an article titled, "Amid Wider Embrace of Digital Services, Milford Bank to Close New Haven Loan Production Office." The Milford Bank has notified state regulators that it plans to close its commercial loan production office in New Haven. The office at 142 Temple Street, Suite 208, does not take deposits and has been focused on commercial lending activity, according to Jorge Santiago, the bank's chief operating officer. The bank plans to close the office pending approval from the State Department of Banking in July. "We chose to close the loan production office because, even though we have seen our lending in the New Haven market increase each year, our lenders have not been actively using the office to meet with clients," Santiago said. "It appears that since 2020, customers and potential customers are much more comfortable and willing to meet using digital channels. We are still able to meet with them, discuss their needs, and provide tailored loan solutions, but we do it remotely or visit them at their place of business, which is more convenient for them." No staff cuts will occur as a result of the office closure, Santiago said. The bank reported 77 full-time equivalent employees at the end of the first quarter, compared to 79 a year earlier, according to Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation data. The Milford Bank, with $597.8 million in assets, established the New Haven Loan Office in 2005. In the first quarter of this year, the bank reported $314,000 in net income, down from $502,000 in the year-ago period, FDIC data shows. It also reported nearly $450 million in total loans and leases on its books at the end of the first quarter. For all of 2023, the bank reported $1.97 million in profits versus $3.1 million in 2022, FDIC data shows. The bank has five regular branches, including four in Milford and one in Stratford. In April, Milford Bank sold a former branch property in its hometown at 295 Boston Post Road for $1.25 million. Milford Bank isn't the only lender to reduce its New Haven office space. Key Bank last year announced the closure of its loan production office at 195 Church Street. We'll now move to the Thursday, June 20th, New York Times business section. We'll start off with the business news roundup. First article in the roundup, Inside Elon Musk's Mission to Win Back Advertisers. As advertising moguls travel to southern France this week for the Cannes Lions Festival, an annual rosé-filled celebration of their industry, the biggest guest was someone who had crudely told many of them to get lost. Elon Musk and his top lieutenant, Linda Yaccarino, were on hand to persuade brands to return to X in a bid to bolster their beleaguered ad business, but it's unclear if their efforts worked. Musk massaged his expletive-filled comments from November. A reminder, at the DealBook Summit, he lashed out at advertisers who had pulled back from X after he had endorsed an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory. When Mark Reed, the CEO of the ad giant WPP, asked Musk about the incident on stage on Wednesday, the ex-owner responded that he wasn't referring to all advertisers. Advertisers have a right to appear next to content that they find compatible with their brands, Musk said, adding what is not cool is insisting that there can be no content that they disagree with on the platform. He added, I do shoot myself in the foot from time to time, but at least you know it is genuine, not from the PR department. Musk met with top ad executives afterward, reportedly including those from the NFL, L'Oreal, Qualcomm, and Target. Separately, Yaccarino talked up X initiatives, including partnering with NBC Universal to stream events from the Paris Olympics and showing more sports docuseries. Some things were working in Musk's favor. The talk of the town was a recent study by the marketing network Stagwell, which found that ads appearing next to content about politics, inflation, and crime perform as well as those shown next to business and entertainment news. In other words, fears about brand safety may be overblown. Musk also touted X's ability to use artificial intelligence to make advertising more effective, including by better matching users with relevant ads. And he said that his social network remains the hub for discussion of live events. If you want to reach the most influential people in the world, X is where to go, he said. So what's at stake? Yaccarino recently told ex-employees the company was winning back advertisers, but big ones were still staying away. That's putting pressure on the company's finances as it labors under a big debt load. The verdict on Musk and Yaccarino's effort is still out. Thousands flocked to the WPP event to hear from Musk, and Reed said that the ex-chief appeared to show an understanding of brand's safety. But unnamed ad executives told Ad Age they remained wary, given Musk's antagonism towards social issues they cared about. Others felt bummed after hearing his thoughts on AI, which he suggested could do marketing executives' jobs better than they can. You're supposed to inspire people, not tell them they're not going to have a job, Reed said. There's four short stories in what's happening in a business world. Number one, the Bank of England leaves interest rates at 5.25%. The move was widely expected just 2 weeks before Britain's general election, and with consumer prices remaining under pressure despite inflation falling to the central bank's 2% target. The decision was announced after the Swiss National Bank this morning lowered its prime lending rate for the second time this year. Next, a cyber attack stalls U.S. car sales. CDK Global, a software provider to thousands of dealerships nationwide, reported on Wednesday that it had to shut its systems down for hours after an incident. The company did not disclose the cause, but there have been a series of high-profile cyber attacks on businesses in recent weeks. And Instagram is said to recommend inappropriate content to children. New academic research found that the photo-sharing app shared sexual videos with 13-year-olds, the Wall Street Journal reports, despite executives having said that the service would give teens more age-appropriate content. The news comes as some researchers pushed back at calls by Dr. Vivek Murthy, the U.S. Surgeon General, to impose a warning label on social media over its potential for adverse effects on children's mental health. And fourthly, Golden Goose blames Europe's economic and political uncertainty for delaying its IPO. The Italian luxury footwear brand said snap elections in France and the results of European Parliament elections had caused a significant deterioration in market conditions. It probably did not help that Francesco Pasqualizzi, an executive at the private equity giant Permira and one of Golden Goose's biggest backers, got cold feet, the Financial Times reports. Next article from the Business Roundup, rising heat, cooling interest. The record-setting heat wave that's been scorching the Midwest and the Northeast is expected to linger into early next week, triggering health warnings as triple-digit temperatures bake some cities and are expected to test the electricity grid. The pre-summer blast, the solstice arrives on Thursday, coincides with a new report that planet-warming greenhouse gas emissions hit a record last year despite growing investment in renewable energy. It also comes as Wall Street's commitment to sustainable investing has come under strain amid a red state pushback and pullback by climate investors. A reminder, last year was the hottest globally in modern times. Rising temperatures have been anything but gradual, with heat waves getting hotter, longer, deadlier, and costlier. Each summer, the U.S. spends roughly $1 billion on heat-related healthcare costs. Yet climate is increasingly sitting on the back burner. The economy, immigration, and social issues are topping voters' lists of concerns. If re-elected, Donald Trump would likely demote it even further as a priority. Wall Street isn't embracing the issue as much as it used to. Finance giants have largely withdrawn from international climate treaties and sought to water down rules around climate disclosure, The Times' Lydia DePillis writes. What explains this apparent disconnect? In some cases, it's a classic prisoner's dilemma. If firms collectively shift to cleaner energy, a cooler climate benefits everyone more in the future. But in the short term, each firm has an individual incentive to cash in on fossil fuels, making the transition much harder to achieve. And when it comes to avoiding climate damage to their own operations, the financial industry is generally struggling to comprehend what a warming future will mean. Some investors are backing off as well. Climate-related shareholder proposals have been losing investor support in recent years, according to a recent RBC Capital Markets research note. That was true even before ExxonMobil sued two activist investors in January over their shareholder proposal that called on the energy giant to accelerate its carbon emission reduction plans. The investors withdrew their initiative. And tech giants are facing a climate reckoning. Their embrace of artificial intelligence has led to a staggering amount of electricity use and lakes of water to cool down the data centers that power their services. Next article in the Business Roundup, AI boom versus AI safety. Investor enthusiasm for artificial intelligence isn't abating. Neither are questions about how the technology will be deployed. After months of speculation, Ilya Sutskever, a top researcher who left OpenAI last month, unveiled a new safety-first AI startup on Wednesday. That comes just after NVIDIA, which dominates the market for AI chips, became the world's most valuable public company. Sutskever's post OpenAI Future has been a talking point. He co-founded OpenAI but helped oust Sam Altman as CEO last year over concerns that Altman could not be trusted to run a company that's working to create a machine that could supersede human intelligence. Sutskever later backed Altman's return, but Sutskever's own exit was probably inevitable. The new company's goal is to safely create an AI system that is more intelligent than humans. But Sutskever told Bloomberg that his new venture, Safe Superintelligence, exists as a research lab and has no plans to sell its services or products. It will be fully insulated from the outside pressures of having to deal with a large and complicated product and having to be stuck in a competitive rat race, he said. How to achieve that is less clear. Sutskever didn't reveal his financial backers or how much he's raised. His co-founders are Daniel Gross, who worked on AI at Apple and is now a tech investor, and Daniel Levy, who worked with Sutskever at OpenAI. Gross was also a partner at Y Combinator, the tech incubator that Altman ran. Safe Superintelligence founding principles sound familiar. OpenAI was started with similar aims, but the company went on to raise billions and partnered with Microsoft and others, partly because it needed the money and access to big tech's data to build its AI. It's unclear how Safe Superintelligence will confront the same challenges that OpenAI did. The founder's reputation may be enough to attract investors. Companies that are seen as leading in the field are powering a wide market rally. NVIDIA's market value has soared roughly eightfold to $3 trillion in less than 2 years, propelling it past Microsoft and Apple. And startups from OpenAI to Francis Mistral are raising huge amounts of money at massive valuations. Some businesses are fighting back. Forbes has threatened legal action against Perplexity, accusing the AI search unicorn of stealing text and images without permission, Axios reports. Perplexity's CEO defended its chatbot as a product that has some rough edges, but a Wired investigation suggests that Perplexity's problems are more than a glitch. The New York Times has sued OpenAI and its partner Microsoft, claiming copyright infringement of news content related to training AI systems. Well, you're listening to the Chris Business Hour. I'll be back with the final segment of this week's show after this break.
The American School for the Deaf recently launched their Lost in Translation campaign to raise awareness around communications accessibility challenges experienced among the deaf, hard of hearing, and deaf-blind communities in Connecticut, especially in areas of healthcare and education. Through this project, the American School for the Deaf will work with hospital and education systems to identify areas of need and provide solutions to ensure deaf, hard of hearing, and deaf-blind citizens have full communication access during the most critical times of their lives. For more information, visit their website, asd-1817.org. The American School for the Deaf, always able.
From the New York Times, an article written by Noam Scheiber titled, Amazon is fined nearly $6 million over warehouse work quotas. A California labor regulator said on Tuesday that it had fined Amazon nearly $6 million for thousands of violations of a safety law that took effect in 2022. The measure, known as the Waterhouse Quotas Law, lets employees request written explanations of any productivity quotas that apply to them, as well as explanations of any discipline they may face in failing to meet the quotas. The State Labor Commissioner's Office said Amazon violated the law more than 59,000 times at two Southern California warehouses between October and March. The system that Amazon used in the two warehouses is exactly the kind of system that the warehouse quotas law was put in place to prevent, the labor commissioner, Lilia Garcia Brower, said in a statement. An Amazon spokeswoman said in a statement that the company had appealed the penalties and denied that the company used fixed quotas. The spokeswoman, Maureen Lynch Vogel, said that individual performance is evaluated over a long period of time in relation to how the entire site's team is performing and that workers can review their performance whenever they wish. The California law also proscribes quotas that interfere with employees' ability to take state-mandated breaks or use the bathroom, or that prevent employers from following state health and safety laws. Experts have said the law was among the first in the country to regulate warehouse quotas that are monitored by algorithms and to require employers to make the quotas transparent to workers. The penalties announced on Tuesday are the largest issued under the law. The Labor Commissioner's Office said its investigation has been assisted by a labor advocacy group, the Warehouse Worker Resource Center, which issued a statement quoting a worker at one of the penalized Amazon facilities who described significant pressure to hit quotas. If you don't scan enough items, you will get written up, said the worker, Carrie Stone, adding, "This happened to me. I got written up for not making rate. They said I missed by 1 point, but I didn't even know what the target was." Other Amazon workers raised similar concerns while the legislature debated the bill in 2021, and studies by labor advocacy groups have shown that Amazon has significantly higher rates of serious injury than other warehouse employers like Walmart. The Federal Occupational Safety and Health Administration has cited Amazon several times in recent years for exposing workers to ergonomic injuries and over record-keeping for such injuries, and the Justice Department is investigating whether the company made false representations about its safety record when applying for loans. Amazon has cited hundreds of millions of dollars worth of investments in safety improvements in recent years, including more than $300 million in 2021. Other states like New York and Washington have since enacted similar laws, and Senator Edward Markey, a Democrat of Massachusetts, introduced a federal version last month. Next, from the New York Times, an article written by Alan Rappaport titled, U.S. Debt on Pace to Top $56 Trillion Over the Next 10 Years. The United States is on a pace to add trillions of dollars to its national debt over the next decade, borrowing money more quickly than previously expected at a time when big legislative fights loom over taxes and spending. The Congressional Budget Office said on Tuesday that the U.S. national debt is poised to top $56 trillion by 2034, as rising spending and interest expenses outpace tax revenues. The mounting costs of Social Security and Medicare continue to weigh on the nation's finances, along with rising interest rates, which have made it more costly for the federal government to borrow huge sums of money. As a result, the United States is expected to continue running large budget deficits, which are the gap between what America spends and what it receives through taxes and other revenue. The budget deficit in 2024 is projected to be $1.9 trillion, up from a forecast earlier this year of $1.6 trillion. Over the next 10 years, the annual deficit is projected to swell to $2.9 trillion. As a share of the economy, debt held by the public in 2034 will be 122% of gross domestic product, up from 99% in 2024. The new projections come as lawmakers are gearing up for a big tax and spending battle. Most of the 2017 Trump tax cuts will expire in 2025, forcing lawmakers to decide whether to renew them and, if so, how to pay for them. The United States will also again have to deal with a statutory cap on how much it can borrow. Congress agreed last year to suspend the debt limit and allow the federal government to keep borrowing until next January. Those fights over tax and spending will be taking place at a time when the country's fiscal backdrop is increasingly grim. An aging population continues to weigh on America's old age and retirement programs, which are facing long-term shortfalls that could result in reduced retirement and medical benefits. Both Democrats and Republicans expressed concern about the national debt as inflation and interest rates soared over the last few years, but spending has been difficult to corral. The CBO report assumes that the 2017 tax cuts are not extended, but that is highly unlikely. President Biden has said he will extend some of the tax cuts, including those for low and middle income earners, and former President Donald Trump has said he will extend all of them if he wins in November. Fully extending the tax cuts could cost around $5 trillion over 10 years. The bigger projected deficits were largely driven by the Biden administration's decision to cancel more than $100 billion in student loan debt, the cost of new aid packages for Ukraine and Israel, and higher than expected outlays for Medicaid. The CBO also said an agreement by lawmakers, which Republicans insisted upon, to claw back $20 billion from the Internal Revenue Service would reduce revenues from corporate and individual income taxes by about $32 billion through 2034. That assumption stems from an expectation that the IRS money would be used to crack down on tax cheats, resulting in more federal revenue. The White House blamed the Trump tax cuts for the red ink and warned on Tuesday that Republicans will only add to it if they control Washington. Republican officials are already plotting to grow the deficit even more in 2025 with tax handouts to the corporations who are keeping prices high even as inflation falls, said Andrew Bates, a White House spokesman. High interest rates are also making it harder for the United States to manage its debt burden. The budget office predicts that annual interest rate costs will rise to $1.7 trillion in 2034 from $892 billion this year. At that point, the U.S. would be spending about as much on interest payments as it does on Medicare. The harmful effects of higher interest rates fueling higher interest costs on a huge existing debt load are continuing and leading to additional borrowing, said Michael Peterson, chief executive of the Peter Peterson Foundation, which promotes fiscal restraint. It's the definition of unsustainable, he added. Senate Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa, the top Republican on the Senate Budget Committee, said that Mr. Biden was responsible for high borrowing costs and called for spending cuts. The Biden administration has saddled generations of Americans with inflationary conditions and astronomical interest rates, Mr. Grassley said. The budget office said that one change in the American economy in recent years is actually helping to reduce deficits and debt over time, a surge in immigration. That's because new immigrant workers are expected to pay nearly $1 trillion more in taxes than they will consume in government benefits. The office said the United States is on pace to add about 8.7 million more immigrants from 2021 through 2026 than historical trends would predict. They are expected to pay taxes that add $1.2 trillion in federal revenues over the course of a decade while consuming about $300 billion in federal benefits, primarily in federal health insurance subsidies for adults and children. The costs and benefits of immigration continue to be contentious political issues in the United States. The Biden administration on Tuesday announced new protections for immigrants who have been living in the United States illegally but are married to American citizens, shielding them from deportation and giving them the ability to work legally. Next, from the New York Times, an article written by Danielle Kay. Is titled, EV Maker Fisker Files for Bankruptcy as Cash Runs Short. Fisker filed for bankruptcy protection late on Monday, the latest startup in the electrical vehicle industry to fall short after raising large amounts of money from investors with lofty expectations. Fisker's bankruptcy filing, roughly 1 year after it delivered its first vehicle and almost 4 years after it went public, came after months of doubts about its financial viability. The startup repeatedly cut production targets for its flagship Ocean SUV and faced escalating financial turmoil, warning of substantial doubt that it could continue as a going concern in February, pausing production in March, and defaulting on a loan repayment in May. Talks with another automaker about a potential investment broke down earlier this year, and the company's beaten down stock, which once put the company's value at several billion dollars, was delisted from the New York Stock Exchange for abnormally low price levels. Fisker had delivered over 6,400 vehicles by mid-April, it said. It outsourced production and emphasized its design and software, such as a rotating dashboard screen. Fisker is looking to sell its assets, which its bankruptcy filing listed as worth $500 million to $1 billion. The company listed liabilities of $100 million to $500 million, with Adobe and Google among its largest creditors. Like other companies in the electric vehicle industry, we have faced various market and macroeconomic headwinds that have impacted our ability to operate efficiently, Fisker said in a statement announcing its Chapter 11 petition filed in Delaware. Demand for electric vehicles, while brisk, has disappointed auto executives, raising questions about heavy investments in new models and factories, even at market leaders like Tesla. Intensifying competition from Chinese automakers is also a worry for Western executives. Fisker was among the EV startups that raised billions of dollars on the promise of rapid growth, making their market debuts by merging with special purpose acquisition companies in 2020 and 2021. Some of those firms, including Lordstown Motors, Arrival, and Proterra, have also filed for bankruptcy. Others, like Canoe and Nikola, have struggled financially. Fisker's filing is the second time its founder, Henrik Fisker, has overseen a car company that has gone bankrupt. His previous venture, Fisker Automotive, filed for Chapter 11 protection in 2013. Sarah Foss, the global head of legal and restructuring at the financial services company DebtWire, said that although Lordstown and Proterra became much leaner companies after selling assets through Chapter 11 bankruptcy, the road ahead for Fisker could be rocky. That's because the company appears to be entering bankruptcy while still searching for a buyer for its assets and negotiating with financial stakeholders, she said. John Paul McDuffie, a professor of management at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, said that software and design problems contributed to the startup's setbacks. It was failing to master some of these crucial aspects of being a car company, he said. Well, you've been listening to the Chris Business Hour. I'm Barry Slater. Thank you for listening. Have a great day, and thank you for letting me give you the business.